Although, to be sure, we're going to do a, we'll read pieces and parts of it. Whenever you're ready. For 40 long days, oh, here's the thing too. You have to pay attention to me today because I didn't make any slides. Although, I should have a brief word of thanks here. I do thank Ellen for stepping up and doing the reading today, because Linda was supposed to do the reading, but Beth isn't here, so Linda went upstairs to run the sound. Thank you very much, Linda. Did a great job today running the slides and sound. And Ellen stepped into her job, and wow, just really worked out well. So thank you very much, ladies. Appreciate that very much. For 40 days, the army of Israel had stood on the eastern side of the valley. Listen. Day after day, he would go out, and in his rough and guttural voice, he would bellow complaint, his disrespect, defiance. It's rather easy to suspect that Goliath was an unhappy man, except that he seemed to take particular delight in referring to the people of Israel as dogs who were not worthy to eat the pickings from his table. Day after day, he would go out and start his tirade. And on more than one occasion, he would invoke the name of his gods and call down curses. Goliath thus made this more than a battle of strength, more than a battle of will. He made this a theological battle. Goliath represented not only the Philistine army, the pagan Philistine gods. Make no mistake, Goliath was a religious man. Goliath, they called him. He was a big man, close to 10 feet tall. And when he was dressed for battle, he was even more intimidating. Who knows if he slept in that armor or not. But it must have taken several hours to get it on his body each day, nonetheless. The armor was thick and must have, to you and me, weighed a ton. He was a bronze monster, and when the sun glinted off the bronze on his body, he looked downright majestic. I can imagine that the Israelite army must have been afraid. And why not? Here was a man who was left a leftover, so to speak, from another time in the world, another age of men. Giants, they used to be called. And when Caleb and Joshua went to explore the promised land with 10 other people from Israel, one from each tribe, they came back, and 10 of them said this. They said, "We are like grasshoppers in our own eyes. We're so big." Now, you and I, of course, we're far more advanced and educated. We don't believe in giants anymore. Nowadays, giants are more likely to be some physical ailment inside the self than another person outside the self. And although, to be sure, some professional athletes are rather large, that armor, wow. That armor certainly made Goliath appear godlike, radiant, majestic, giant that he was. Goliath was a big man. Dressed in battle garb, he was downright spectacular. His rough, gravelly voice really added to the fierceness of his appearance. He taunted Israel day after day after day, but all of Israel, led by their fearless leader, the writer of Samuel tells us, were dismayed and terrified. And they fled before him in great Saul, their king, leading the charge of fear and disillusion and dismay. In the face of Goliath, who wouldn't, though? I'd run. Wouldn't you? Well, I don't know. Maybe I'd sit back and watch someone else do the fighting for a while. Sometimes it's easier to sit back and watch someone else do the fighting. That's what David's brothers accused him of. You just came down here to watch the fight. But Israel wasn't even close. Goliath was down in the valley. Israel was looking down, and still Goliath was a giant from a distance. And I think in his size we see not just a very large man who must be overcome, but rather the imposing nature of those who defy God. Right? You see, his taunt was no mere, was no small thing. Invoking pagan gods was no small thing. One man against the armies of the living God was no small thing, but he did it. But you see, no one heard what Goliath was saying or saw what he was doing. No one in Israel could figure out that Goliath was mocking God. He was simply a big man that wanted to pick a fight with an army. And if, to be sure, anyone did hear him, they were not quite willing to do anything about it. No one was willing to take a stand against this atheological elephant in the room. Goliath considered himself invincible in his armor and his size. And since they did nothing to challenge him, we can safely assume that Israel, too, thought he was invincible. But there was a weakness, I tell you, because the gods of this age are not at all powerful. They are not real. And the Scripture assures us that the gods of this age have already been judged. They have already been cast down. We need not fear them. You see, Goliath stood as a representative against the righteousness of God. But not just Israel, but the God who made Israel. This was no mere battle for territory or for flesh. This was a battle of grand theological proportions. Here is Elijah versus Baal on Mount Carmel. Here is Jesus versus Satan in the desert. Here is Gideon versus Asherah and Baal. Here is Samson versus Dagon. Here is Joshua versus Molech. It is Paul versus Caesar. It is the great battle of all time. It is every battle that pits righteousness versus unrighteousness. Righteousness versus death, freedom versus slavery, God versus atheism. How are we willing to let people go? At what point do we have to take a stand against the forces of darkness and stand up in the righteousness of Christ against the powers of this present dark world, against the blasphemers, against the unholy, and everything that is opposed to righteousness, against the principalities and powers of this dark world? How often, how soon must we do these things and go to war? But even if you and I have never seen or a giant or participated in a wrestling match to the death with a giant, Israel had seen giants. Israel was not unaccustomed to seeing very large people roaming the hills and valleys of Canaan. Maybe they were the legend, the stuff of myth. But big people were not altogether fiction. I don't think Goliath was an anomaly. In fact, their own king, Saul, we are told. We are told that Saul was a man who stood than anyone else. Saul was no small man. He was large. We are told by the prophet Samuel, "Do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people." Saul was nothing to be scoffed at. He was no small man. Israel had a champion. His name was Saul. But Saul was a man who had a very low opinion of himself, a head taller than anyone else there. And yet he was hidden among the baggage when it came time to collect him for kingship. And when certain people refused to acknowledge Saul was the king and pay him tribute, the Bible says that Saul remained quiet and wouldn't even stand up for himself. Big man that Saul was, he was just as unwilling to do anything of what God had declared was right and true and just. The king was to be the champion, the defender of righteousness, the defender of holiness, the defender of God's cause and his people. But there was Saul, ahead of anyone else, possessing more armor than anyone in Israel, having more armor bearers than anyone deserved, and he would not go out and acknowledge this Goliath of a man. Saul did lead the charge, right? Of being terrified, of fear. Saul was not quite a champion, but we know, too, from reading ahead of the chapters in advance that by this time the Spirit of the Lord had left Saul. He was quite unaccompanied. He was alone to make decisions on his own, and he was making the best one that he could make at that given time and in that particular circumstance, and that was this: stay in the tent. He wasn't leaving the tent. And it makes one wonder, doesn't it? Doesn't it make you wonder? Why all their champions, but those of Christ do not? The gods of the pagans have their champions who stand day after day and shout their defiance at the armies of God, shout their blasphemies and tirades. And what do we do see day after day, but church after church making concessions, giving ground, cowering inside their tents, their enclaves, their fortresses? Are there no champions for the cause of Christ? Are there no kings standing ahead taller than who will stand up and declare righteousness, holiness for the God, the armies of Israel? We have our champions. I'm sad to say the champions are those who write the books, and those who have pretty faces. But who are the champions? Who are the shepherds who will stand out for the sheep? It's not the mighty warriors who stepped out of the ranks of Israel that day, right? And fought. It was the small. It was the unassuming. The one others thought should just shut up. It was he who stepped out of the ranks. It was he, that one who believed that faith mattered. It was the one who had a higher opinion of God than he did of himself. He figured, I reason, that God's holy name is worth at least the cost of his own life. This is the one who would go. The giant would not get away with his blasphemies for another day. Not as long as this man was around. So we come to the last character in the story named David. A young man, not quite a boy of popular folk songs. A man named David. He was the son of a man named Jesse, but as it would be, David was only the smallest, the youngest. There were seven others in front of him, convincingly more powerful. Eliab, Abinadab, Shammah for three. These three mighty ones had followed Saul into war against Philistia. But not David. David went back and forth between Saul and sheep. It's ironic that we are told that David's brothers followed Saul into war, since there was really not any war going on at the time anyway. They were just lined up on each side, kind of shouting and arguing with each other. Goliath would come out each day and shout his blasphemies. Israel will get up each day, draw the battle lines, and shout the war cry, we're told. There wasn't really any war. It's like this war cry. Afraid at the sight of war, they ran away from him. This was no impressive army. This was no army that would defeat that pagan army with torches, pottery, and shouts like Gideon's 300 did. No, this is a different kind of army. And for 40 days, Goliath came out and shouted at the Israelite army. And on one particular day, we are told, the young man from Bethlehem named David heard it. Of all the 58 verses in chapter 17, the two words that are the most significant, three words that are the most significant are these: David heard it. David heard Goliath's blasphemies. And he's clear on this point. David heard it. I don't know if David saw who shouted defiance or not, but I believe that David heard it. And here's David, a shepherd, an errand boy, not even considered worthy to go and fight for his father like his older brothers did. David is good enough to carry cheese and bread and good news to his brothers and back and forth, take care of sheep, but he's not considered worthy enough or even old enough to fight. He had ears, though. And he heard someone say something. Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down here to me. And if he's able to fight and kill me, why, we'll become your subjects. But if I fight and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us. This day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other. Israel heard him, but David heard him. And so Israel fled before the sight of this man and the sound of his voice. 40 days is a long time to live in fear. Who will be the champion and accept this challenge? Eliab? Abinadab? Shammah? Saul? The numbers are wearing thin, and Israel was running out of options. And at the front lines that day, a young man described as ruddy and handsome, a good-looking young man, a cheese carrier, a sheep herder, happened to be at the front lines. The youngest of his father's eight sons, he played. And yet he's described as a brave man and a warrior who speaks well and is fine-looking. More thing, the Bible tells us, was with him. If Goliath filled the gap between David and the entire Israelite army's faith, David the youngest, the smallest, you see, David heard what Goliath said. But you see, here's the other thing. David believed in God. Huh? And David must have believed something about it. David believed that God would not let people be defied by the heathen and with impurity. Or maybe David was convinced of the reality of God's power and his willingness to intervene on behalf of his people. Or maybe David thought that the mere name of Yahweh would be sufficient to topple this giant. Maybe David arrived at the wrong time. Imagine if Goliath had announced his defiance. Never. But on the fourth day, David arrived to do his errands, and maybe David just wanted to make a name for himself because he was tired of being considered the least in his family. I don't know. That shepherd boy who tended those few sheep in the desert, maybe David was sick and tired of being the youngest, and he thought he had something to prove. After all, he had been the underdog, we're told, in numerous battles with lions and bears, and yet the Lord had always given David victory. He was always the underdog. A big fan of the underdog. You see, David was a guy who would fight for one lousy sheep that was carried off by a bear or a lion. That sounds strikingly familiar. He would fight for one lousy sheep. Maybe now he would fight for the underdog Israelite army of the living God. Whatever it is, I'm glad that Goliath was unrighteous enough, brazen enough, brash enough to announce his challenge for 40 days and not 39. I'm glad that David arrived just in time to hear it. You see, sometimes, oftentimes, the forces of evil simply do not know when to stop. They do not know when enough is pushing and pushing and pushing. And maybe 40 days of hearing the same thing, the Israelite army had simply grown weary of hearing it. Maybe they grew complacent. Maybe they just didn't care anymore. I think the enemy has a way like that. Keep pounding us over and over again over the head with the same lies and defiance day after day until we're so tired of hearing it that we simply cave in or start ignoring it. And so David came to deliver bread and cheese. And David, we're told, David heard it. It's obvious that David garnered no respect from his family. His brother quieted him down. David said, "Can't I even speak now? Now what have I done? I can't even talk." Saul didn't think David could do it. Saul said, "You're just a boy. You can't go out and fight the Philistine. He's been a fighting man since his youth, and you're just a boy." Too inexperienced, too small. James Smith notes that the fate of the entire army and the kingdom rested on the shoulders of one who had no military experience. But to be the name, I think that's exactly the point. I think that's exactly the point. You see, to David, this was not a military battle, or David would have approached it from a military standpoint. He would have developed a strategy, a plan of attack. He would have worn army and battle clothes. Maybe he would have prayed a line or two. Maybe he would have picked up a sword or a spear himself. But he didn't. Saul thought it was a military battle. He tried to dress David in his armor. David shrugged it off. He tried to take a sword, but he left it behind. He didn't take an armor bearer. He didn't take bow. He had no sword backing him up. No plan of attack, no counterattack, nothing. David went out to face Goliath. Goliath in his mighty armor, shining in the sun, David went out and said, "I come against you in the name of the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." You see, David didn't view this as a military battle. David viewed this as a theological battle.
When David went out naked, dressed only in the garb of a shepherd. Well, what if a shepherd goes out and fights a battle against a giant? So David took his staff. Staff is a shepherd's tool. He chose stones from the stream, not a supply of advanced weaponry from the armory. He put stones in the shepherd's back, we're told. He carried a sling. Why are we continuing to hold that David was a shepherd going out to fight a battle against a soldier? A shepherd against a warrior. A young man versus a battle-hardened soldier. A small Israelite versus a Philistine. A man with nothing but a rock in his pocket, a sling in his hand, faith in God. A soldier of the enemy versus lion, shepherd versus bear, Jesus versus Satan, Elijah versus Baal, Gideon versus a sheriff, Moses versus Pharaoh, Joshua versus Molech, Luke Skywalker versus the emperor. Crippled Roosevelt, healthy vegetarian Hitler. Imagine it. The irony. A far away from Kansas. Becoming arguably one of the greatest military generals in the history of warfare. Going against the hardened Nazi Field Marshal Rommel. Do you get the sense from the size of the army or the enemy in the battle that matters? But if the story of Gideon taught us about a God who wins with 300 versus 130,000, then this story teaches us nothing short of the same, that God wins even when small shepherds go up against mighty warriors. And I should say God wins especially when small, unassuming shepherds take up their place outside the ranks of the mighty. David, warrior that he was no soldier yet, but he saw sheep that needed shepherding. David saw sheep that needed defending. And that's what a shepherd does. Goliath saw in David the same thing everybody else saw, a boy, handsome and ruddy. And it says that Goliath despised him. And yet I bet it also made him shake just a little bit. And to walk towards David, but David, he sprinted towards Goliath. And David returned to favor. You came at me with spear and javelin, but I am the Lord Almighty, the God whom you have died. This day the Lord will hand you over. I'll strike you down, and I'll cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God. All those gathered here will know. It is not by the sword, not by the spear that the Lord saves. For the battle says, here it is, the battle is the Lord's. He will give all of you into our hands. See, David knew the stakes. He knew this was much more than a battle of armies. He knew what was at stake was the supremacy of God, whose God is real. David knew that Goliath had not defied the army of Israel, but the God whom they represented. And I suspect up to this point the Philistines had to wonder, is there a God in Israel? No one going to come out here day after day and face Goliath? I bet the Philistines wondered, is there a God in Israel? Is there no one with the courage to come out and defend his honor? You see, I think there was a time when the righteous and holy name of the Lord our God was honored by, and his righteous folk defended his honor and his holy name, but not so anymore. David believed something that the rest of the Israelites believed. David believed that it mattered and that God rewards faith. David at least believed that there was a God in Israel. And you can see how that was a minority point of view that day. Goliath didn't believe it. The Philistines didn't believe it. Saul and the Israelites didn't believe it. David was an underdog who stood his ground because of what he believed. That's it. The battle didn't last that long. Wasn't really much of a battle to speak of, was it? David ran at Goliath. I see Joshua charging into Jericho. I see the church charging into the gates of hell. I see Daniel charging into the lion's den. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego dancing in the fiery furnace. I see Deborah and Barak leading the charge against Sisera's army. David ran at Goliath. He plunked him in the head with a smooth stone. And it was this stone that killed Goliath.
Only after the stone hit Goliath and knocked him dead did David take Goliath's own sword and cut off his head. That rhymes, by the way. David took the head of Goliath to Jerusalem, probably threw it over the wall as a sign of things to come to the Jebusites who were living there at the time. And that was it. The battle was over. David's legacy had begun. But more importantly, the legacy of God had been resurrected among the people. And the question I would ask is this. Why was David willing to do this thing that neither Saul nor his army were willing to do? I think it's rather simple. David knew his history. Huh? I think David knew his history. That's right. But these sermons are not about people or the people involved in them, but rather about the God whom the people serve. So when I say that David knew his history, what I mean to say is that David knew that history belongs to God. Because he is the God of history. David knew what happened. Joshua and Caleb went into the promised land and brought back the report. The men that went with them said, well, we're like grasshoppers in our own eyes. But Joshua and Caleb, filled with faith, said, nah, let's go. God has given the land into our hands. What are we waiting for? But because people listened to the majority, well, whoever says the majority is right. Huh? But you see, there were a mess of people who didn't believe, and that unbelief cost them 40 years in the desert. And a whole generation never saw the promised land. David knew what happened when Joshua led Israel into Canaan and began to evict the owners of that land. David knew the stories of Samson and Gideon and Deborah. And he knew beyond doubt the story of Moses and Pharaoh. David knew his history, and he knew the God of history. And because David knew this, paganism cannot stand up to the power of the righteous God. And so David's not afraid to go out and confront a circumcised fellow who dares to defy the name of God. How do I know he knew this? Where else do you think that such courage and faith come from? You don't dare go into battle against an enemy like Goliath unless you know how it's going to turn out ahead. David continually the armies of the living God. You see, I think David knew before he ever stepped foot into the battle that day that he was going to win. No doubt in my mind, David knew the battle, he said, belonged to the Lord. And David knew Goliath's weakness. What weakness does a 10-foot man shrouded in bronze armor have? Not many, right? But I suspect that David knew that the weakness was more than a bare spot on his head where the rock hit. I suspect that David knew that Goliath's weakness was the very unrighteousness that he stood for. You see, he defied the armies of the living God. David knew this was a battle not just for kings and soldiers, but for righteousness versus unrighteousness. The very unrighteousness that Goliath continued to spew out day after day for over a month was his very undoing. It was this that was his defeat. Unrighteousness and unholiness will not stand long in the presence of a holy and righteous God or in the presence of the people who are willing to stand up for it. And so what do we do? What battles do we fight? We don't fight giants of people like Goliath now, but I suppose. But we do fight battles, and the spirit of Goliath is still alive and among us. His loud, obnoxious voice that rattles the windows of our buildings. His voice is the voice of the enemy who tells the people that there are many ways to be saved. That's the spirit of Goliath. You don't need Jesus. But have we sent out a champion from the ranks of the armies of the living God, or have we hidden ourselves under the wings of politicians and money and niceness? Niceness. Don't want to be offensive. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings here this morning, but the Bible is pretty clear that there's only one way to the Father, and that is through the Son. But niceness, they might not come back. The voice of Goliath defies the church to do anything about unrighteousness, eh? We might be called dogs if we dare to call unrighteousness what it is, or if we dare to challenge someone's assumptions about God, or if we dare to say enough of using God's name to justify every act of unrighteousness and unholiness and every teaching that spews forth from the publishing houses and the television sets. Someone might sue us. Someone might threaten us. Someone might be offended if we dare to have the nerve to say there is only one way to God, and that is through His Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. Someone might be offended. And apart from Him, you have no life. And apart from Him, there remains only outer darkness, where the worm does not die, where the fire is not quenched, where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. David said it. What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And then David said something else. He said this. Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go out and fight him. Oh, I think that by this time the people of Israel, the nation, the army, even the king, they were dismayed. They were dispirited. They had nothing left. But David says, pluck up your courage, man. I'll go. The smallest, the weakest, the one who's told simply to shut up, I'll go. And I'll win. And it's not arrogance, because David knew that the battle didn't belong to him, but the Lord. And I think the church needs more people like David in that sense. That is, who truly know the God of history. Or people who are righteousness of the Philistine world. More people who are tired of the blasphemies that are uttered in God's name. More Davids who are tired of the very leaders that stand head and shoulders above the rest, abusing that authority and leading the charge of fear and dismay. And what mighty things did God do with David the underdog? God did mighty things with this mere keeper of a few sheep. God did greater things with the smaller one than the great armies that day. And I believe that God honors and is willing to step out of the ranks, to step out and stare, but rush right at it and knock it down and cut off its head. The enemy is formidable and formidably armed, but the enemy has a weakness. You see, the enemy has a weakness because the enemy is against God. And no one who is against God can stand. Like Elijah, like Jesus versus against Nebuchadnezzar, like Abraham against Sodom and Gomorrah, like Joshua against Jericho, David stood against the unholiness that was Goliath, and though the odds were in man's eyes against him, David prevailed, because in God's eyes, David towered over Goliath. And I suspect, finally, that David had one thing right in what he did in the battle against Goliath that day. You'll notice that David left behind the sword, didn't he? And when it was all said and done, he used the very weapon of the unrighteousness to undo righteousness. He used Goliath's own sword to kill him. David left the sword because this was not a battle that was going to be won with a sword. This battle, in David's words, was the Lord's battle. And here's the key. David was the weapon of choice that day. Not a sword. It was David. The battle was the Lord's. It was God going up against Goliath that day. And David was the Lord's weapon of choice. Methinks that there are battles that the Lord will fight even today because He is great and powerful. But the Lord desires a weapon in His hand. And I think that we are the weapon that He chooses to use to fight and win the battles of righteousness versus unrighteousness in this world. But who among us will be champions? Who among us is small enough to admit that what is necessary is not strength of weaponry, but faith in God? Who among us will be the Lord's weapon in the battle that we fight? I'd like to stand now and sing our